This is the Great Discontent Podcast. This conversation was recorded in front of a studio audience at the Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, as part of TGD Live, a monthly interview event series. Your lovely and well-dressed host for the night was Tina Esmaker. Enjoy the show.
So tonight we actually are starting off with a performance. Hope you guys are ready to laugh. So I'm going to introduce our first guest, and then he's going to come up and perform, and then him and I are going to chat for a few. So let me get my fancy intro ready. Our first guest is a stand-up comedian from New York City. His debut album, Hot Flashes, is out now. He's a comic because he likes to tell the truth, and he realized that being funny is the best way to do that. He talks about relationships, politics, race, religion, technology, and sex. He's also the creator of Vooza, a video comic strip about the tech world, which was called The Spinal Tap of Startups by Mashable. And he co-produced Hot Soup, one of the hottest live comedy shows in New York City. He's been seen on MTV's Girl Code and The Comedy Show on CISO. He's also been featured on CNN.com, Huffington Post, New York Magazine, Time Out, and he's appeared at comedy venues and festivals around the country. Please give a warm welcome to Matt Ruby.
Keep it going to Tina for setting this whole thing up, everyone. Yeah, good to be here. This is going to be an interesting stand-up comedy set. Why not? I like the room tone as forced meditation dynamic. Nothing New Yorkers like less than having to shut up for 30 seconds. They're like, is it over yet? Is it happening? All right, but I'm going to tell some jokes for like 10 minutes and then we'll sit down and chat. Where to begin? Well, this is my look, you know, it's like Pitbull if he was Jewish. That's my thing, you know, just Oy vey gasolina, yeah. No, I don't know. I got called creepy by a magician last week. That's a wake-up call, right? Feels weird. I don't know. I've never been married, but I feel like I have the energy of a guy who's doing really well with his divorce. I feel like that's... Like, I don't see the kids enough, but I'm going to Burning Man, that kind of dude, you know? That's what I'm putting out in the universe. And, yeah, I'm going bald. That's, I got to grow the beard. That's what we have to do, bald dudes. I don't know why. You're not going to notice the desert up here because of the waterfall down here, I think is the theory. But, I don't know, now my beard's just going gray, so I feel like death's chasing me around the house. It's like the worst game of hide and seek ever. It's such a weird solution, too. And people are like, oh, you just shave it all off. Be confident about it. I'm like, that's your solution to going bald? To go bald faster? It's like, I don't think you get how solutions work. So like, we don't do this with other stuff. And the world's not like some guy's like, yeah, I'm having a really tough time finding a job. Oh, you know what you should do? Be homeless. Yeah. Just sleep under a bridge. Be confident about it. No one says that. I am a Jewish fellow. This is an interesting time of year to be a Jew. I feel like whatever like Jewish holidays and Christian holidays happen at the same time, I feel like it just proves how much better Christian people are at marketing. Do you know what I mean? Because like Christmas is great. It's jolly fat guy rides around in a sled, throws gifts down your chimney. It's a good time. Meanwhile, Hanukkah's like, we only bought enough oil for one night and it lasted for eight. What a bargain. Should make it a holiday, a festival of good value. I don't know. Now Nazis are making a comeback. God damn. Yeah, Nazis are kind of like bell bottoms. You always think we're done with them, and 20 years goes by, and like, ah, someone's really pulling it off. How about that? So I see these guys in Charlottesville being like, Jews will not replace us. Jews will not replace us. And I'm like, what part of your crappy hillbilly lives do you think Jews are coming for? Like, here's a sentence that's never been said, that Jew stole my job at the coal mine. Never been said. We're a very claustrophobic people. Only way you're getting Jews into a coal mine if there's like fresh lox and bagels down there. That's the only way that's happening. You know what I mean? There's no Jewish duck dynasty. That's not a thing. There'd be a bunch of old Jews in the bayou being like, oish, this humidity, I'm schwitzing. But yeah, I don't know. Everyone's sensitive nowadays. It's tough. It's tough out there. This Muslim ban, I'm opposed to that. I don't know. It's like, I feel like everyone's just fine banning stuff that they're not around. Like big city liberals, we're fine banning guns because we're not around them. Red state conservatives, they're fine banning Muslims because they're not around them. I think what we need is an exchange program. Do you know what I mean? All big city liberals should have to go to a fire range, fire a gun, and be like, wow, this is super fun. Then all red state conservatives should have to go to a hookah bar and eat baba ganoush and falafel and be like, wow, this is super delicious. the hell were we thinking? Because it's easy to ban stuff that you don't need. Like, if someone came up and was like, well, we've got a new ban. I'm like, well, wait a minute. What are you going to ban? They're like, man buns and Magnum condoms. I'm like, yeah, that's fine with me. Go ahead. I ain't going to the airport on their behalf. I'll tell you that much. You know? Or someone's like, we got a new ban. I'm like, wait a minute. What are you going to ban? They're like, Rogaine and pornography. I'm like, my people have suffered enough. Got to talk about the Constitution. And then, I don't know, Trump said Mexico sending all their drug dealers and rapists to America. The first thing he said was running for president. Mexico sending all their drug dealers and rapists to America. Have you seen who we send to Cancun? It's not exactly the cream of the crop that we've been exporting south of the border. Not a lot of Rhodes Scholars at Senior Frogs, if you know what I'm saying. Like, every year, there's like a month where we just send the drunkest, dumbest people we have to the exact same city in Mexico. Like a Ramadan of stupidity that they must endure. And at this point, I'm kind of shocked Mexico hasn't demanded a wall, actually. Like, Mexico's like, we demand a wall. We're like, why? And they're like, you keep sending lacrosse players from Penn State named Connor. Ugh. They all take Molly and listen to Tiesto. They applaud when the plane lands. It's weird. Like, touche, Mexico. You bring up a good point. I don't know. There's one group of people that we're all fine hating on, though, which is women who are basic. I don't know why that's... Everyone's on board with that. Even other women do it all the time. Like, look at this basic bitch. Look at how basic she is. I'm like, well, what does that even mean? It's like, you know, she drinks rosé all day. She rides around a giant inflatable swan in a pool in the Hamptons. She goes to SoulCycle. She watches The Bachelor. She's got a Michael Kors purse. I'm like, yeah, that all sounds amazing. She is living my best life. I'm jealous. Are you mad at her because she's cozy? Is that the problem here? Because honestly, I sit around my apartment in my boxers, vaping, watching SportsCenter, eating Hot Pockets. I'm pretty sure I'm basic as fuck. I own the Entourage movie. I'm the problem. Let's be honest. Oh... Yeah. Did you guys hear they started that national database that tracks your religion and race and location? Yeah, yeah. It's called Facebook. Have you heard about it? Yeah, we're just giving it to them. I don't know if you know this, but it's a volunteer program. I don't know. I'm addicted to my phone and technology. Like the other day, I had to go to the bathroom without my phone. I didn't know what to do with myself. Just started swiping on towels. Like, that one's ugly. Ooh, that one's hot. Yeah. Open the shower curtain every 30 seconds. What's new, shower? What happened? Just shampoo every time. But yeah, I love getting drunk and taking Uber, though. That's probably my favorite technology. When I get drunk and take Uber, it's the closest I get to feeling like a billionaire. It's true. I just step outside the bar. I'm like, my chariot awaits. Takest thou Manhattan Bridge, Muhammad? Why, yes, we should pick up two drunk sorority girls in the Lower East Side along the way. Good idea. Although, I'll tell you, I don't like Uber always tells you that the car is going to be there like in 2 minutes and then winds up taking a half hour to get there. I don't like that because it's the exact opposite of what I promise ladies in the bedroom. I was like, I'll totally take a half hour. And then a minute later, I'm like, arriving now! Oh! Would you like a bottle of water and a charger? Sorry. And then I think also when you got out of the bar, there's usually like four different Ubers waiting there. You never know which one's yours. I kind of feel like that's the grown-up version of playing Clue. Because when you're a kid, you're like, okay, it's Professor Plum in the library with a candlestick. And then as a grown-up, you're like, okay, it's Eddie in a Kia Optima with license plate TH3. Eddie, where are you? Eddie, is that you? He's like, I'm Kevin. Like, you are not the father. All right. But yeah, I spend a lot of time on the Facebook. Oh, boy, it's a whole thing, huh? You know who pisses me off on Facebook? They get the most likes, too. These married couples who feel the need to tell you how much they love their husband or wife. Via Facebook, like it's, you know what the marriage is really like too. You know the reality. Yet every anniversary, it's like opening night on Broadway. You know, it's like 12 years ago today. I met the love of my life, Harold. He's my best friend, my teacher, my comrade, my spiritual guru. I'm so humbled and blessed to have Harold in my life. The other day, he made me poached eggs, breakfast in bed, just the way I'm like, hey, you live with him. Tell him, all right. God damn, when did I sign up for your relationship theater? When did that happen? Because you could go down on them in front of me, and that would be better than this, honestly. This is too much PDA. I'm not having it. And I also get jealous of ladies, too, for how supportive of each other you are on Facebook. so supportive. You know, when that new profile photo goes up and the supportive female friend mafia descends on the comment section. You know, all it is a new haircut, but everyone's got, it's like a bat signal for compliments went out. You know, the photo goes up, it's like, OMG, you look gorgeous. Yes, queen, 27 exclamation points. You know, everyone's got to top it from there. I literally can't even. And that hand clap emoji one, like, you are a goddess. That is not my Facebook experience at all. Like, I could post a photo of LeBron James and the Loch Ness Monster finding that missing Malaysian airplane. One comment from my uncle asking me to call him. And I'm flagged as inappropriate. I don't even know why that part happens. All right, I feel like that's good enough. I'm Matt Ruby. Thank you. We can do some Q&A now.
Thank you.
Sure.
Oh, man. I can't even ask questions. I'm just laughing too hard over there. All right. So thank you for making us laugh. It's raining outside. We all needed a good laugh.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. So
feels weird. Now I have to be a normal human being.
Yeah,
now,
I mean, you can still tell jokes. Just don't make me the subject of the jokes. Be nice to me. We get to talk about you a little bit right now, and you can tell me whatever you want, because I don't know anything about you. I did a little research online, but you can make things up if you want. But tell me a little bit about where you grew up and how your childhood influenced your ideas about creativity and what was possible.
Sure. So my mom was like very creative and a hippie and an artist and poet and sculptor. And my dad was a prosecutor and assistant DA in New York City and a total law and order guy. So I feel like I'm just the civil war that it was inherited between the two of them. Like half my brain is like, don't do drugs. And the other half's like, why, you got some? I don't know. I guess, you know, my dad was obsessed with the Marx Brothers and James Bond. And so I feel like I grew up just thinking like being somewhere in between Groucho Marx and Sean Connery as James Bond was like the pinnacle of what you should go for. And then I remember I was in therapy one time and my therapist asked me about my mom, if she was really into comedy. And I was like, no, I don't even remember ever seeing her laugh at all. And it was one of those like light bulb moments where it just comes out of your mouth. You're like, oh, fuck. God damn it. This is why you go to therapy. This is why it happens. And you're like, yeah, I don't even remember seeing my mom laugh. No wonder I spend my life trying to make strangers laugh. All right. All adds up. So, I always liked making stuff as a kid. I spent years in a band doing music stuff before I ever did comedy. And, you know, I like writing and taking photos and making stuff. I feel like, I don't know, we're all going to die, and like making stuff along the way seems like the best use of time that I've found.
I would second that. So you, you're doing comedy now, but you've done a lot of different things. You actually worked in tech at one point. You probably knew I was going to talk about this.
Sure.
It's not a secret. It's on the internet. But you were, were you employee number one at 37 Signals, which is now Basecamp? And you were there for, I think, 10 years. Mm-hmm. And you started as a designer, and then you focused on media. So I don't know. Tell me a little bit about that period of life, or like, what did you learn while working there besides gaining fodder for your jokes now?
I got to work with some really smart people, and we kind of started off as a web design firm, and we made this product something to manage our projects because we couldn't find anything out there that was working well. And then every client that we had asked if they could use that same software to manage their projects, and we're like, oh, maybe there's a product here, and turned it into a product. And, you know, sort of taking a company from nothing to something, and was definitely like a sort of inspirational thing to be along the ride for. And I'd say maybe what influenced me was like we were very sort of out of the Silicon Valley mode of thinking, and sort of a different path of don't take investment funding, build something small, try to have a real product, charge money for it, don't spend money on advertising, promote yourself through teaching and educating other people and trying to share information. And yeah, trying to build a real business in the old fashioned sense of having something that you sell that people want to pay money for, which is in the world of technology, some crazy idea where everyone's trying to just monetize attention. And through that, I wound up, you know, writing books and, you know, a blog and other stuff about how to start a business. And then eventually I was like, huh, maybe I should try to start a business. So I wound up leaving the company and starting my own video production company that produces a show, and tech companies and other people hire us to make funny videos and explainer videos and commercials and other things for them. So it's sort of been this long and winding path along the way. But I guess I was doing technology stuff, and then I was doing comedy stuff, and then I had this sort of personal unification theory of, like, is there a way for me to combine what I've learned with technology and what I know in comedy and access to the talent pool of New York comedy, where there's a lot of talented people. And what came out of that was the show Vooza and the video production company that I have now.
Yeah, I was going to ask, was it because when you're working in tech at 37 Signals, that was in Chicago, mm-hmm. and then you left there and moved to New York. So was it a risk for you at the time? And did you know at the time that you wanted to pursue comedy, or was that still something that was just in your mind as an idea?
I did not know. It wasn't that much of a risk because half the company then and still now worked remotely because, you know, we made software that enabled people to work remotely. So I kept working there even after I moved from Chicago to New York. I don't know. I think I didn't. When I moved to New York, I was still making music. I'd been in a band in Chicago and I put out a solo album, and I was sort of doing singer-songwriter shows around New York City. And I was like, I don't like singer-songwriters. I don't want to be one. Like, I liked being in a band, but singer-songwriters always feels like some dude wearing a scarf who's trying to sleep with your girlfriend. And I was just like, it's fucking annoying. And at the same time, I was living in the East Village, and there was a place called Rafifi, which has since shut down. But it was a video store. In the back, they had a showroom where there was these incredible, like, free or cheap comedy shows every night of the week, where I got to see people like David Cross and Patton Oswalt and Zach Galifianakis and younger people at the time, like John Mulaney and Nick Kroll, sort of like these incredible, like, neat comedy shows. And that to me felt more rock and roll than any of the music stuff I was seeing in New York at that time. I'd always loved comedy, but I hadn't thought about trying it until I kind of started seeing it multiple times a week, and decided to one time give it a shot. And then all of a sudden it was like a rabbit hole that, like, 10 years later now, it's like a fungus that's grown over my entire life.
Yeah, because the comedy is just like, do you just decide one day that you're going to go do stand-up, and then you do it, and you're like, I was really bad at that. Maybe I shouldn't do it anymore, that was actually better than I thought it would be. I'm going to keep trying. Did you train? Did you study? Did you just practice?
Yeah, I mean, I took this sort of class for like a couple months, which is kind of just like a supportive open mic. But yeah, the only way to get good is to go to open mics, and it's a really, like, sort of brutal endeavor for a few years of being in basements with really, like, surly and crazy. And, you know, there's a couple, like, talented people who you're like, that person will go somewhere. And then there's, for every, like, one of those, there's like six other people that you're like, oh, that's a homeless person who wants a microphone. And you just kind of navigate that obstacle course for a few years. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's something about, I guess, to compare it to other creative stuff that I've done before, or being in a band, or other, like, I think comedy is the most sort of collaborative art form there is, as far as, like, the performer and the audience are kind of making it together. And there's something, so when it's bad, it's really, like, awful and humbling and, you know, kind of painful. But when it's good, it's this really, like, sort of transcendent kind of beautiful thing. And I think especially in this day and age, when we're all so tied to our phones and screens and stuff, to when there's a room full of people kind of connecting on a wavelength where they're a little bit of a hive mind or some sort of organic community is formed, that it feels, you know, special. And to me, it's somewhat of like a sacred thing that comedians get to do. And that's part of why it's definitely addictive, though. Also, it's one of those things where, you know, you take a couple nights off, even, you're like, oh shit, I missed this. What, I'm losing it, and you need a new fix. So it's this ongoing sort of fill in a leaky bucket, almost, in a way.
That's awesome. You have a new album out. Is it your first full
length? It's my first stand-up comedy album. Yeah.
And we can listen to that it's on iTunes.
It's on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you stream albums, you can hear it.
Wherever.
It's called Hot Flashes.
And so what's next? If people want to check out your work, come see a show, where can they find you around New York City? But not in a stalkerish way.
My calendar is public. You can stalk me all you want. Every Tuesday night I have a show. Well, except for this Tuesday. I mean, the show is still happening. I'm just not there. in Midtown East at a place called Irish Exit. So that's like a cool sort of free show in a back of a bar setting, but it's really good comedians. If you want to come check that out, I perform regularly at Comedy Cellar and other places around town. And my website is vooza.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Matt Ruby. And I got a newsletter you can subscribe to, and mattrubycomedy.com. Is this enough? I feel like that's enough for plugs.
I think that's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
We all agree.
We're all in agreement. Thank you so much, Matt, for coming out, making us laugh, and spending the night with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Matt Ruby, everybody.
Look, you've likely heard of MailChimp, and there's a good reason why. More than 15 million people use MailChimp to connect with their customers, market their products, and grow their e-commerce businesses every day. But here's something you might not know. You can run Facebook ad campaigns right from MailChimp. Use the same simple design tools they give you for email to create great-looking ads. You can target ads at your audience or people similar to them, which is a great way to reach new customers. Track sales, customers, and subscribers all in one unified dashboard for both advertising and email. If you're looking to up your email game or try your hand at a Facebook ad campaign, MailChimp has the tools you need to grow your company in a way that feels right for you. We want to thank them for supporting the Great Discontent podcast. MailChimp. Send better email, sell more stuff.
Our second guest is a multidisciplinary artist from Venezuela who runs her own studio in Brooklyn, New York. She focuses on books, lettering, typeface design, and experimental handwriting. In 2015, she was named a new visual artist, 15 Under 30, by Print Magazine, and she's a type at Cooper and Prodiseño alumna. She teaches, speaks at conferences, draws zines, makes goodies, and runs Yes Equal, a database of women in the creative fields. Please welcome Isabel Urbina Peña. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. So excited to have you here. I saw you speak at the AIGA National Conference this year, and you spoke in the Craft Symposium, and you took us through a process of how you design book covers and showed a lot of your work, which is beautiful. We're not going to show it tonight because audio and people at home can't see it, and they would be really sad. But your work is stunning. So I'm so excited to learn more about your personal path. So I want to start at the beginning. Tell me a little bit about growing up in Venezuela and how your childhood influenced your ideas about creativity.
Well, I had a pretty nice childhood. Mm-hmm. My parents are both architects, so I was very much in a creative path since I was a kid. Like, they were putting me in like writing classes and like poetry classes and pottery classes and all these stuff. And my dad is also a painter, so he was like, come, let's paint this. And he would sit me down to like paint like a Van Gogh, and I would like try to imitate it, and I was like, this is really good. No. I really want to find that, but yeah, it's, I don't know where it is. And I really remember that moment that I finished it, and I was like, this is good. And I was like 7 or 6 or something. But yeah, they were super encouraging.
That's amazing. Such self-confidence. Well, we can just end now because I feel like such a loser.
That's it. And now we're here.
Yeah, so you mentioned, so your parents are architects, and you grew up surrounded by artists and musicians, designers, and you actually consider becoming an architect yourself. So what changed your mind? Why did you not become an architect?
I think it was a little of rebellion on my part. I was like, oh, I don't know. Do I want to do the same thing that my parents do? Not really. And my mom was really focused on me going to college, and design in Venezuela, it's not really a career. It's not like the Ministry of Education doesn't recognize it as a career. It's not a BFA, even though it's 4 years. It's more informal. So they were like, go to university. And I was like, okay, I'll do like art because I don't want to do architecture because you already do that. And I'm like seeing that every day. So I kind of wanted to find my own path. So I did theory and critic of the arts for like 1.5 years. And then I started studying design.
So you did study design in Venezuela.
Yeah.
And then you later studied at Cooper Union. So walk us through that timeline. Like, what was that experience like for you? And how did your education at both of those institutions prepare you for work after graduation? Or not?
Well, yeah. well, the school that I went to is great, but it was a tiny house, so it was like really strange situation. Like it was really informal, and it was very good at teaching you how to think, but it wasn't great about your portfolio or like how to sell yourself. So basically, when I decided I wanted to move to New York in 2008, it was a pretty big change, and I didn't really know where to start exactly. So in that sense, it wasn't really easy as a transition. Like, I came here with no plan, and I was like, okay, I'm going to freelance, I guess. And I was also, like, teaching swimming lessons. That was, like, what was paying my bills, actually. Because I went to, like, in my high school, I was a swimmer and I did other sports, so I was, like, doing that. And design was, like, I wanted to focus on it, but it wasn't my main thing. So it was kind of trying to figure out connections and, like, obviously we all know how important networking is, and, like, when you move here, you know, from another country and English is not your first language, it's not easy to find that. So it was kind of interesting to like start meeting people, getting more acquainted with like technical terms, because I learned in another language basically. And then eventually I decided to do the Cooper Type program, but that was like a couple years after I moved here.
Okay, I didn't realize that it wasn't right straight away. So you were working, doing freelance design, trying to build your portfolio, and giving swimming lessons because you had to pay the bills.
Yeah.
Which I love that part of the story. It's so great.
Yeah, it was awesome, actually. I'm not very much of a kiddie person at the time. And then I was like, kids are awesome. I love them. So I discovered something new, which was pretty cool. but yeah, I moved here, and then I started freelancing. I found an internship at a Museum of Natural History, which was really cool, but it was unpaid, so that was kind of like, okay, I need to still work and do some stuff. And then after a while, I found a job at a design studio that's called CNG Partners, which is actually the following studio from, it came from Chef Meyer and Geismar, that, sorry, I just read that he passed away today, and we saw him. Anyway, I worked there for 2 years, and then while I was there, I was like, you know what? This is not working. I'm doing web design. I really love print. I want to go to Cooper Union because they have this awesome program, and I applied, and I got in, and I was like, I'm out. Bye. And then I started the program, which was pretty cool.
Got it. So, so tell me a little bit about, did your focus shift after Cooper when you were out? You were still doing freelance? Yes.
Yeah, it shifted because, I mean, I got the confidence that I didn't have on doing my own drawing. Like, they had a really nice setup where you met a lot of calligraphers, sign painters, lettering artists. So I started like learning from them and also getting, you know, more excited about drawing by hand, which was something that I had tried in Venezuela, but not really, you know, in a design studio setting, it might not be the thing that you're doing. And that kind of brought me back to, you know, my thing with my dad and like drawing with him and just like really get confident there. So when that happened, I felt like, oh, I actually love lettering. Like I was pretty into typography, but this got me more in a path, I think. And it gave me the confidence to start doing it more and more. And after that, I got a job as a book cover designer, which was like more exploration on that because it's all type, you know, like there's so much typographic content that you can play with.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love how you brought that back to the Van Gogh artwork. It's just like this theme in your life.
Yeah,
you just
yeah.
keep. I wanted to talk about your book cover designs because you share. So you've designed covers for how many books now?
I lost count, to be honest. I'm sorry.
Like a range.
I think it's definitely over 50, less than 100.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
But also, so many designs get killed that it might be over, you know, like a couple hundred. Maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's what I wanted to talk about, because you share, well, in your talk at AIGA and then also on your Instagram, you share covers that have been killed, and you even have a hashtag for those covers. What is it?
Cover archive. Killed,
yeah. Killed cover archive. So sad. But I love that you share the rejected covers because they're so beautiful. I'm like, why would anyone not choose this, right? But I'm not an art director, so for a good reason. And so yeah, so despite those covers not being chosen, the work is really great. But you know, what have you learned through the process of letting go of some of the work that you do? I mean, obviously you're putting your heart and your soul into your work and then it's not chosen. Like, what does that feel like? And how do you make the work knowing that it might never go out into the world?
Okay, so there's two parts of this, because one part is that you are really sad, you know, like you made this thing that you think it's great. And you're like, this is so exciting. I'm connecting with it. I think the author would love it. And then the author never gets to see it. That's heartbreaking. But at the same time, it also allows you, in a way, to like experiment with so many different styles. So I think that's great, because the reason that I'm not like an illustrator or maybe even a painter is because I don't want to have a particular style, so that I feel like it gives me the freedom to like try different things that I'm interested in, but not necessarily married to that. And at the same time, when you see everything together, you find like something that connects all the work, but it's not necessarily, you know, that style that people come, you know, to some illustrators for. So it's pretty experimental, and that's the positive side, I think.
But. And I like that you're showing the work that never, that doesn't get chosen and that hasn't gone out into the world. So
that's also my way of dealing with it. I think.
Yes. Like, here, someone is going to see this work.
Someone will see it. It's okay. I can let go now.
My Instagram followers will see it.
Yeah.
So yeah, you've designed covers for best-selling authors like Dave Eggers, and your cover for Dana Mengistu's All Our Names was included in the New York Times list for best covers of 2014. That must have felt pretty great.
That was awesome.
Yeah, it is a great cover. You guys have to go home and Google it, or get out your phones and Google it. So yeah, what is it like to see your work out in the world?
I mean, for me, it's really exciting. And it's also like when you go into a book cover and you see, you know, your stuff, like, oh, you know, this person who works here decided to put it on the front of the store. It's like, it feels really great. And it's, you know, an exciting moment, and it doesn't really get old for me. I don't know. I'm pretty like proud about doing the work, because I'm like super, I will go all the way. Like, I really want to put everything I have into each cover. So when I see that people appreciate it, it's just like, oh, thanks. I worked a lot on this. It's awesome.
And what other types of work are you focusing on right now? Because you run your own studio here in New York.
Well, I'm doing a lot of like lettering, and I'm starting to do more zines. And me and my studio mates who are here today, hi. we got a risograph, so I've been experimenting with that a lot, which has been fun. And that's part of the great thing about like having my own time to like play with that. But I'm also doing more and more typeface design, because it's really, I don't know, it's fun. It also gives you a different type of project. Like, you're not designing for yourself or someone who's gonna see a final thing, but you're designing actually something that other people will use. So it's a pretty different connection with that, and I'm like really into that. But yeah, also, you know, a little graphic design and books. I've been doing more and more interiors and like the full book. So that's been fun, but I'm always open to new projects also.
That's awesome. And what do your parents think? Are they okay that you didn't become an architect? Do you send them your books? Like, hey, I designed
okay
this
now. Yeah, my mom was pretty heartbroken, I think. She was like, how are you doing this to me? How is this possible? But no, I think they're really happy. They're also like, all of their friends are graphic designers. So I think they're pretty happy about what I'm doing.
I'm sure they're happy that you're happy. Right.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, we're going to bring up, are you ready for some company?
Yeah, totally.
We're going to bring up another guest.
Let's do it.
Our third and final guest of the evening.
Cool.
Our third and final guest is an illustrator and Los Angeles native currently based in Brooklyn, New York. She's a graduate of Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. Her clients include the New York Times, Pentagram, New Yorker, Coach, Good Magazine, The Independent, and many, many more that I shall not list. She received the ADC Young Guns Award, and her work has been recognized by American Illustration and Communication Arts. Please welcome Ping Zhu. Woo! Welcome.
Thanks.
I've actually interviewed you before.
Here we are.
We're going to do the same one again. No, yes. Just kidding. I met Ping in 2014. I interviewed her in person. We went to a little cafe in East Village and sat outside, and it was very nice out. And we had, I think, wine and cheese. If we could get some wine and cheese on stage right now, can anyone assist with that?
ASAP.
We're missing some things from the stage. But yeah, I'm excited to catch up because that was, 3 years ago, and I haven't seen you since then. Maybe in passing at events that were
both. You look great.
You do too. Awesome. Making me feel so good. So I do want to give some context for your path. So I want to go back a little bit, like rewind, kind of start where I'd like to start, which is childhood. So tell me about your childhood growing up in California. I know your experience was a little bit different.
From Isabel's?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, just slightly.
Slightly.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
So I grew up in California, and it was a very comfortable suburban life. My parents were not architects. They were both meteorologists. They studied that in China. And then so deciding to rebel against them was pretty easy because I had no interest in the sciences. And I felt like it just took many years of convincing them that art was something that I could do for a living rather than something that was just, you know, graffitizing people's notebooks or writing cool names in bubble letters. And I think that it felt like convincing them, like they needed some kind of proof that I was also dedicated to this craft. Although, you know, 16-year-old me had no idea what I was talking about, but I was very good at explaining, like, yeah, you know, like this New Yorker cover, someone did that, that's art, someone drew this, that could be me one day. And it hasn't, and it probably never will, but you know, it was like something that I could use to prove to them that like art was something that you could make a living from. And I think that maybe they were just exhausted from me arguing with them all the time, but eventually, like getting into Art Center, I also was like, I'm not applying to any universities, I'm only applying to art school. So I gave them like three options, and you know, one of them was SVA, but it was just really expensive to live in New York, and Art Center was really close to where I was living. So I ended up living at home when I was in college, but you know, I was like driving to college and staying there as much as I could to get away from them and just, you know, but then I think it wasn't until much later in my time in college that I really figured out what illustration even was. I was like, oh, so it is not simply drawing. It is also application and concept and skill and context and all these other things. And I think by the time I finally actually left school, it was like, oh, this is not the pitch that I sold my parents on, but it was something that was like I had to convince myself in another way. So yeah.
And so you also have a Van Gogh story.
What's my Van Gogh story?
Well, I don't know, you told me this.
I didn't reread my interview
when we spoke.
Was I supposed to?
Previously. I'll fill you in.
Okay, please.
I'll give you some hints. So your parents were meteorologists, and they were into science, but your father appreciated the arts, or so you told me.
That's true.
Yes. Do you remember the story now?
I do remember.
I'll let you tell it.
Okay. So, my dad was the one who brought me to a lot of museums when I was a kid, and I think he always had a really good, like, appreciation for the arts, where he never really explained it to me. I think he just brought me along to the museums. He was like, oh, like, we're going to go to this one and this one. And I was just, you know, just along for the ride. And we did end up going to the Van Gogh, like, retrospective that was at the LACMA. Like, I don't know how long ago this was at this point, but I was, like, this tall. It's, like, 3 feet off the ground. And I just remember thinking, when I was in there, like, everyone was super tall because they were adults and I was a child, and all the paintings were hung to the height of adults and I couldn't see anything pretty much. But I think, I don't know, I think I've just felt like, you know, the gallery world was such a, I didn't know if I wanted to be a painter or what, but it just felt like, you know, people were interested in these paintings and it was something that, you know, there's a reason why people were here, and it seemed really interesting to me at the time. But, you know, I still don't really remember, like, what exactly, I guess, like, why it stuck out to me as a memory. But I think just the idea that my dad, like, still wanted to bring me, even though I was, like, too young to really understand what was going on. I really appreciate the fact that he did that, because I think it still, like, pushed me to explore it further.
Yeah, and from when you were speaking a minute ago, it sounded like you knew from a young age that you were interested in the arts. You just didn't know what form that would take in your life.
Yeah, I think that was because I wasn't very good at other things and I didn't really care about them enough. I was like, math, or like, you know, like history, okay, like, you know, they're all dead, whatever, you know. It was like a very dismissive attitude. And I think I just really wanted to, the kind of undercurrent of that was that I just wanted to find something that I could identify with or that I could be recognized in. So I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm not very good at math and I'm not very good at history, so I can't remember these dates, and like, I'm not good at writing because, you know, there's, it just seemed like with all those things there was always going to be someone else that was like very good at it, and I just was like, I don't want that competition, you know, or like, I just don't think I stand a chance in that. And not standing a chance in something made me feel a little bit discouraged or like low confidence, and I felt like drawing was just one of those things that I think a lot of people's parents were like, don't do that, it's a waste of time. And I was like, perfect. It was like, I found the thing that I was like, I will weasel my way into this and I will make it work for me.
The aha moment, you yeah. heard it here.
Right.
Yeah, I want to, you know, this goes, it's along the same lines. I want to quote something you said when I interviewed you in 2014. You said, I didn't like the idea of doing something I didn't enjoy or feel passionate about when I had all these feelings for something else. My parents wanted me to consider other occupations and have a backup plan, but I wanted to follow my instincts and see if that would lead to something good. So that's exactly what you did. You applied only to art schools, went to Art Center, and then you spent a little bit of time in London before coming to New York City. So tell me a little bit about your time in London and then what brought you to New York.
Yeah, so I went to London after I graduated from Art Center, and it was an opportunity that I had to live there for a few years, and I wasn't there for work. It was mainly I was freelancing and I was with someone who had a job there. And I found it very difficult because I had pretty much decided in the same kind of brash rationale that I had when I was like going from high school to college and all through college into whatever my future was, that I was like, oh, I'm just going to do this thing and it's going to be fine. And then I was like, oh, I have no friends. I have no family. I like don't know anything about this culture. I don't know how to count money or cross the street. I am, you know, I was pretty much realized that I didn't know anything. And I feel like that was an extremely intimidating aspect of moving to a new country. I'm sure you counted dollars just fine. But I think there was some aspect of that that made me feel very reclusive. And luckily, illustration is also like something you can do in isolation. The internet was like here and I was just like crying over here doing this. And I was like, who's going to care about this? And so I think in order to like reach out and try and find people who would recognize my existence, I used Instagram pretty much to just like, first it was like my parents who were like, what are you doing, are you alive? And I'm like, yes. And I would like take a photo on Instagram of just like some stupid drawing that I did. It was like, you know, 5 followers. It was like my parents and like 1 friend and 2 strangers. And then eventually it was just like, but it was like a nice reason to like get up in the morning and like still draw stuff. So it was like, oh, okay, so I have this audience in quotations, and I, you know, I have a reason to do stuff. So it slowly just became a platform, and I think that was also when Instagram was starting to become a thing that people were using to, you know, promote themselves or to show what they did or what they ate. That was very popular. And I think I slowly like kind of got in touch with the community of illustrators in London. And eventually, I think in the last year and a half, I managed to find a studio space and was able to like split a desk with another illustrator. And I think that kind of opened like a small door, but it was like a very difficult time to like kind of get started again, because these were people who had friends that they went to school with, and they were all like, they all grew up in the UK, and it felt very much like they didn't skip a beat, where I was like, you know, still figuring out which side of the street to look on to cross. So I like those 3 years felt like 30 years. Like, it was really difficult, but at the same time, I feel like it was also the only way that I can learn, where I'm like, oh, if I'm like too comfortable, like California was very comfortable and I didn't feel like I would learn very much there. So being in this land of mysteries was actually quite necessary for me. And I think after the time that I was there, I realized that most of my clients were coming from the US and specifically from New York, because I do a lot of editorial work. So it was like, you know, why am I getting US dollars converted into pounds and then it being obliterated because there's like nothing left after that? So it was like, well, I have no money to begin with. So now I'm even poorer and there's no money to like learn how to count, essentially. So I was like, I have to move home. So I moved back to the US, and because I've always wanted to live in New York, because you know, this place is the shit. So I was like, you know, here I am. But I made that move kind of like also diving in without realizing what I was getting myself into. I was like, I don't know if I can pay my rent, but I'm gonna do it. You know, like, I felt more optimistic about the fact that I'd already like gone through this urban experience of torture in London, and I was like, well, at least I know that my sense of space will be as like limited as it was there, so I'll be fine, you know, I'll figure out how to pay rent and whatever. So that's how I ended up in New York. And here I am still.
We're glad you're here.
Thanks.
Isabel, does that resonate with you at all, the experience of being somewhere that's so different and having to acclimate and just being like, what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like all the stuff that you're saying, like, oh, everyone was here and they knew how to do things. Like, I feel like that. Like, when I moved here, it was like everyone had their amazing portfolios and I was like, I haven't printed my work out. Like, I was just thinking and making great ideas, and now it's like all in a JPEG. And then I had to like figure all that stuff out, and like how you connect with, you know, the communities, like you were saying, like, I don't know, when you feel like a door opens, that kind of, for me, I feel like it was Cooper Type, because it was like also where I wanted to go, kind of, and at the same time Random House, I worked there for 3 years, so that was like, whoa, you know, like that exposed my work to a lot of people, and like it is what allows me to be freelance now, I think, because the work is everywhere and it actually has my name on it, people can like reach out to me directly, so it's like how you connect, I don't know. It resonates a lot.
I feel like community is important. Like,
it is.
Depending on how social and in need of other people you are, I definitely feel like having the environment with others just to show them your work and have just someone to talk to about what you're going through that can understand has been very important. So I can't imagine ever going back to working on my like dinner table / work table / weeping zone, you know, it would be so terrible.
Yeah, that changes things.
Yeah,
and you're both freelancers now, but you work out of the same studio in Greenpoint, right? But you're not in... Are you in the same space? No.
No, not in the same space. We're in the same building.
Okay, same building.
Oh,
that's
no,
what I mean.
We're not even in the same
building.
No, not anymore. I was in the pencil factory for a brief moment, and now I'm in 67 West, which is like a block and a half from Ping.
But this is the first time we've seen each other in months.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, got it. So you are both freelancing, but you're in studio spaces where you're around other people. And so, yeah, talk to me about, you know, what's the most rewarding thing about running your own studio as a freelancer?
You're gonna let me go first, huh? Okay. I think for me, the most rewarding part is having control over my own time. Like when you're full time, there's a lot of times, especially in publishing, there's a lot of times where you're like, oh, I got some time to chill. And I was lucky enough to have a boss that would allow me to do other like freelance work in there. But I feel like now I can do so much more with that time because, you know, I can actually, I don't know, go on a trip and then come back and work for a month straight or something. You know, like it's really nice to have that possibility, I think.
Yeah, I think that having a place to go to work has been really great. And also, yeah, being in charge of your own time, which also means that you are the only person to blame if you didn't get anything done that day. I think it takes a lot of responsibility and self-discipline to manage it, but I think the rewards are a lot of freedom and, you know, flexibility and time. For a long time, I was always taking work with me even when I was traveling. Because I paint, I just like packed all my things in my suitcase and took it with me wherever. But nowadays, I think the last trip I went on, I was just like, I will not be taking anything with me and just see how high my anxiety gets. And it was pretty bad for a bit, but I think it was really important to also experience separation from your work in the same way where like having to or choosing to have a studio remotely from where I live and, you know, sleep and all that. It's the distance is required for me to also feel like I have a bit of balance. So that's been good.
And what do you think is, what has been the most challenging for you? Or is there something that you wish you would have known before you started to freelance?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think it's all a learning curve, you know, but for me, what's been like most important this year, I think it's like the power of reaching out. I feel like there's a little bit of like people try to separate themselves from that and try to have people look for them. I want this client to reach out to me to work together. So I'm going to do all this work to get there. And for me, this year has been about like, oh, actually, you know, I want to work with Lenny Letter. Let's write them. And I like kind of like wrote them a lot and like reached out as much as I could. And then I worked with them, you know, and sometimes you think those things are not possible because you don't know someone or you don't want to call email a person, but then you realize, you know, people are actually busy and maybe they don't see your work, even though they could potentially like it. So that has been a really positive, I think, lesson for me.
I think that what I would have liked to know or at least understand if I could have was the value of also personal time and things that are not related to the work that I'm doing. I think because I've never worked in an office or in a studio, like a company, like all my time and my work has been under like with my discretion and I'm choosing to do things. And because for a long time I was like, oh, if I say no, it seems ungrateful. And it like, I essentially like ignored my personal life. And, I think that although I've heard things like work-life balance, I think it's still like an ideal. But I think it's important to like do things that are not related to the craft that you're doing just for perspective, you know, whether it's like reading a book or like, you know, going outside or just like, it doesn't have to be a whole new hobby or anything. I just think that removing yourself so that you have something that you miss and that you can appreciate about your own work is important. And again, it's like maybe that distance that I mentioned earlier, but something about, you know, always staying interested in your work requires you to also like leave it alone for a bit.
Yeah, I like that idea of distance.
Yeah.
Giving space, allowing yourself a chance to miss it. So Ping, you mentioned earlier that you work with traditional media, like you work by hand. You're not on the computer all day making art. I actually said that you find computers a little bit scary.
They're terrifying.
I don't know if that's still...
I mean, Matt mentioned Facebook. That shit's scary. I'm just kidding. I mean, I don't use Facebook.
You're on there, though, aren't you?
I'm not on Facebook.
You're not.
I'm not. Oh. But, I mean, this might also need some updating because I did recently buy a Cintiq, so here I am in the digital world. But I do love the... I mean, I guess I'm trying to not eliminate the possibility of working with certain tools just because they're digital. I would like it to be kind of like an extension of what I'm already doing or something that'll kind of streamline my process. So I do paint with gouache on paper, and, you know, there's never going to be any product technology-wise that's going to replace, like, the randomness of, like, paint on paper. So there's something about that that will always have, like, my heart and my passion. But I think that it completely ignoring the idea that, like, I need a computer to, like, send my files to an art director or, you know, just to communicate with people is, I think, very ignorant. So, like, it's not, I would just would not want it to be my main tool, like, my main crutch or something that kind of overrides what I really enjoy doing just for the sake of, like, ease or, you know, accessibility or something like that. So, yeah. Paint forever, old fashioned, Rembrandt, I don't know.
Van Gogh. And Isabel, how much of your process is by hand versus digital? Like, what does that look like for you?
I mean, I'm no ping, but I think I'm pretty much on the handmade boat a lot, just because I don't want to be in the computer so much. But I also, I found a Cintiq in the trash.
What?
And it works. And it's really big. So now I use it a lot. Close to my house in Greenpoint. Yeah. I was like, what? Yeah.
That's crazy.
I'm a little bit of a hoarder too. Like, so it was like, see why I'm always looking at trash.
You could finally back up
this
your...
like. Really,
hey guys, it paid off.
That's crazy.
It paid off.
I did not get my Cintiq in the garbage.
Yeah.
I paid USDs for that.
So in doing work by hand, like, how do you feel about this idea of embracing the imperfections, right? Because when you're doing it by hand, it's not going to be perfect. So
yeah, I love that part. I think, you know, when other people look at a finished product, they probably think, like, I don't know what they think, actually, but I, what was I going to do there? Like, fucking assume. But anyway, so I think that a lot of it is just trying to see what you can get away with or just embracing the fact that there are things that you can't control. And I feel like that's a general, like, mindset of how, you know, we exist in this world. You know, there's things that are out of your hands. And you know, you can either try and fight that or you can figure out how to embrace it and incorporate it into something that you're trying to say. So that's where my mistakes are in my work.
Yeah, no, I feel like, I don't know, I really like to work by hand because it allows me to discover new things. Like you were saying earlier, like I know how to use the pen, but I want to try to use it in a different way to see what comes out. And that's why I say, like, I do experimental handwriting, because I'm like, oh, I want to try this brush in a way that I shouldn't be using it and see what comes out from that. And I don't think I feel that comfortable with the Cintiq in that sense. Like, I can do stuff that I'm, like, used to. Like, I can replicate stuff that I've already created, but to do new stuff, I feel more comfortable with pen and paper, mm-hmm. pencil and brush mm-hmm. and all that.
Old school.
Yeah.
It's good. So I want to share a quote with you guys, and then I have a question. But I was, this weekend, I finished reading a book by Rebecca Solnit called The Far Away Nearby. It's very good. If anyone wants to put it on their reading list, I would highly recommend it. And she says, creation is always in the dark because you can only do the work of making by not quite knowing what you're doing. By walking into the darkness, not staying in the light. Ideas emerge from edges and shadows to arrive in the light. And though that's where they may be seen by others, that's not where they are born. So I loved that idea that creation happens in the dark and that we don't, none of us ever really know what we're doing. Like, we're following our intuition. We're, I mean, it's not a secret anymore. I just said it. We've said it on past shows. It's a theme that we talk about a lot because I interview people who are in various stages of their careers. And when I'm talking to people who I view as further along and very well accomplished, they will also say, you know, a lot of times I'm following my intuition. I don't know exactly if it's going to work out and I just try it anyway. And that's very comforting to me. But this idea of following our intuition, exploring, discovering, and seeing where it goes. So I don't know. I'm just curious about your thoughts on that. And like, where do you, when you're creating, do you feel like you know what you're doing? Are you a little bit in the dark? Do you, Do you get stuck? Do you draw inspiration from other sources? Like, what? How does that feel for you? Ping is looking at Isabel, so
she's always getting me first.
She's nominating you to answer first.
I'm always in the dark, I think. Always. Until I finish something and I'm like, oh, I think this works. But I like that feeling because it's what actually gets me to a point that I'm doing different stuff. And I feel like if I knew what I was doing every day, I wouldn't be doing it because I'd be bored. I get really bored, so I need to do this to keep myself interested, and that's why I feel like I'd rather take the road that it's like, oh, the unknown. Let's go that way, because I don't know. It's more exciting in the long run. But I do look at stuff. I try to look at more art than actual design, because I think it's hard to not like keep that design in your head. So I try to. If I'm going to look at something, I'll look at art that could be giving me like a tone, a feeling, or something more abstract than a look, you know? But yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't feel like I know what I'm doing, or even if I have a direction or something that I want, it's rarely ever the thing that I get. Mm-hmm. And some of that is because of the medium or like my mental state, or, you know, who's asking for it, or just, you know, any number of reasons that would change the outcome. But I think being open to whatever that outcome may be is just as important as, like, you know, setting forth and like getting there. Yeah. And I think that anyone who says that they like know exactly what they're doing is a liar. So it's like, it just seems like nonsense, because how would you know, you know, like maybe you have to give the impression that you know what you're doing as part of it, but that doesn't mean that, you know, it's like, I would like to know that someone who's flying a plane knows what they're doing, but I feel like, you know, there's just, you have to be also ready for a lot of unknowns, or like, you know, maybe that just means having a backup plan or knowing what to do in a state of emergency. Maybe this is more about flying a plane now, but you know, I think, yeah, I think it's important to be open to possibility, and I think that's a way of accepting whatever direction you end up in, because otherwise maybe you'd end up really miserable because you'd be constantly disappointed, or, you know, maybe not encouraged anymore to do what it is that you do.
Yeah, that's really good. I think also sometimes if we can hang out in that space of not knowing and be okay with it and just go through the process and see what the outcome is, sometimes we're pleasantly surprised. Like, how many people have created really compelling work and they've said, oh, it was a mistake. Like, something happened along the way in the process, and then I took a turn and it became this, when in my mind I wanted it to be this other thing. So I think that's really great. So what advice or insights would you maybe share with someone who is in that place of, you know, maybe they're discouraged or feeling stuck because they're like, I feel like I should know what I'm doing, either in my path or on a particular project.
Okay, I'll go first. Getting stink eyes. I mean, for me personally, I journal a lot. I think finding a different way of expressing yourself often helps, and especially just writing. It's not because I'm trying to write a book. It's just to get my thoughts out on paper so I can look back on it later and just get a sense of what I was feeling at the time. And like often, like dumping out all those thoughts and feelings doesn't really make a lot of sense. And then when I go back and read it, it was like, oh, you know, like maybe I can translate it a little bit or try and understand what it was that I was really wanted to say. And I think that it's natural to feel discouraged or stagnant, but I would ask why. Like, what is it about this moment that feels like this? And is it because you want this feeling because it makes you feel like you're struggling? Or is it because, you know, you're truly lost and maybe you just need a break from this? And, you know, I think that being a creative is highly demanding. You're literally being asked to make things out of nothing on such a constant basis that it seems extremely like demanding and insane sometimes. And, you know, just that you're never going to hit the like bullseye every time. And I think that's totally fine. And just the idea that you're moving and, you know, trying and, you know, like, I don't know, like shifting perspectives, I think small changes are still important. And I think that's valuable. So, you know, have a good cry. It's totally fine. I love crying. It's the best. Crying, journaling, it's all part of my process. Laugh all you want.
I'm also a crier. It's okay.
I'm about to cry right now.
Let's do it. We will later. No, but really, I think what you said, it's amazing. It's totally true. And the other thing that I think, for me at least, it's helpful is to take it a little, like, not as serious. Like, I used to have sketches, like sketchbooks, I mean, and that was the worst ever. I hate sketchbooks. It makes me feel so nervous. I can't deal. Like, I need something that is like, oh, I'll throw this in the trash if it needs to go in the trash because it's terrible. So I use loose sheets of paper. If I'm stuck, I just start with loose sheets of paper, and then I feel like so much less pressure. I don't know. That really helps me, but that's when I'm working by hand, so.
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, of course.
I think it's also important to remember to be kind to yourself. That's something I also forget a lot. I'm really hard on myself when I'm unhappy, or, you know, whether it's a result of something or just because I can't get started. I think, you know, it's probably said that, like, you would never say these things to anyone that you actually care about. And, yeah, you know, like, saying it to yourself is just so cruel sometimes. And I don't think that's helpful. So, you know, just be nice to yourself.
Totally. Those are all really great. Thank you for sharing. So I have one last question. This is our last show of the year. And the new year is quickly approaching. Don't everyone panic, but it is December. And so, yeah, I guess, you know, I've been doing a lot of, you know, as the year ends, I think we all kind of reflect on what have we been doing the past 10, 11 months, and start to think about what lies ahead for next year. So what one word do you want to encapsulate your year next year? I'll give you a minute to think. Like, no one has to pressure anyone to answer first. One word, or it could be a phrase, a sentence, or one word that you want to,
or one word, or just one word,
like a mantra or something for next
year. Yeah, or it could be, look, we're throwing the rules out the window.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't have to be just one word. It could be it could be at least one word. How's that?
Okay. So not a sound.
or it could be a sound. It could be. It has to be audible. Okay. How's that? For the listeners who are listening to the podcast, it needs to be something they can hear. Yeah, what
I think that
next
that,
year
that what you just said is a great future word for next year, being kind to yourself and like lowering your.
I thought you meant my guttural cry earlier.
No, but yeah, just like, you know, it's a job. Even though we love it and we put everything in there, it's also like, you know, we pay our bills with it. So, like, let's take it a little more easy if we can. It's a phrase.
Well, okay. So when I do yoga, which is not frequently, but when they say to, like, do your intention, or, like, the thing in the beginning where you're like, oh, set a goal for yourself, this kind of sounds like that to me. Oftentimes I think of the banh mi sandwich that I'm going to eat afterwards, but other times when I'm not super hungry, I think of, I think patience. Like, I oftentimes don't have it. And yeah, I think that I would like to have more of it, and I would like to remind myself of it, even when it comes to banh mi sandwiches. But yeah, I think patience.
I think that's good. So kindness and patience. And I think that it's been a hell of a year. And I think that going into 2018, we can all, I think if we had more kindness and patience toward ourselves, and if we extended that more to others, it would really make a difference for many of us.
Awesome.
Oh, now I have the warm fuzzies and we're all going to cry up here.
We're kind of about to.
No, those are all the questions I have for you ladies. Ping, Isabel, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
This episode was produced by The Great Discontent and me, Benjamin Welch. The Great Discontent features in-depth conversations with today's artists, makers, and risk takers. You can learn more at thegreatdiscontent.com. And of course, you can subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a rating in iTunes. It really does help spread the word. Thanks so much for listening.